to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Doug Henwood, editor of Left Business Observer, who examines the role of deregulation in the multiple storms battering the U.S. economy. Mary Jane Gallagher of the National Family Planning and Reproductive Health Association, who talks about the Bush administration's effort to implement federal regulations that could severely limit women's access to birth control. And former U.S. prosecutor and author Elizabeth de la Vega, who assesses the scheduled House hearing on one article of impeachment filed by Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The International Court of Justice, also known as the World Court, has ruled the United States should halt the execution of five Mexican nationals who are now on death row in Texas. While the ruling is non-binding, the World Court decision has put more pressure on the Bush administration and Texas Governor Rick Perry to halt these executions. According to the Washington Post, the most pressing case is Jose Medellin, who was convicted 15 years ago of raping and killing two girls in Texas. He's scheduled to be executed on August the 5th. In 2004, the World Court ruled numerous Mexican citizens on death row in Texas deserved to have their case reviewed because they did not have an opportunity to obtain legal representation from Mexican consulates, a right guaranteed by the 1963 Vienna Conventions. After that ruling, President Bush asked Texas courts to comply, but the state refused to cooperate. In March, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Texas courts, asserting they did not have to comply with the World Court ruling. Now, Medellin's lawyers are lobbying Congress to pass a bill requiring federal courts to hold a hearing on all Mexican nationals on death row. According to a June 4th report by the Environmental Integrity Project and Environmental Defense Canada, 800,000 billion barrels of conventional refining capacity will be converted to refined tar sands oil. At the same time, new refinery projects are in development along the Canadian border in Illinois, Michigan, and North Dakota. Tar sands oil creates three times the level of greenhouse gases as does conventional oil. Mining the tar sands in northern Alberta creates other environmental damage. Clear-cutting and strip mining of large tracts of arboreal forest and creation of unrecoverable toxic lakes of wastewater. According to the Guardian newspaper, tar sands operators are planning to nearly triple their oil production by 2011. The industry also hopes to employ 100,000 new workers in northern Alberta. Tar sands development could be frustrated by the tough global warming policies established by the state of California. Conservative activists are gearing up for a fight with the McCain campaign over the Republican platform that will be hashed out at the GOP convention in St. Paul, Minnesota in early September. Right-wing activists will try to stop any effort to moderate the party platform, especially on issues like global warming, immigration, and stem cell research. As Jessica Eckhart of the Arch Conservative Eagle Forum told the Washington Post, "We're kind of waiting in anticipation because we don't know how McCain is going to thread the needle between party moderates and conservatives." In the U.S. Senate, McCain has endorsed the cap and tap scheme to control global warming. Yet, many Republicans see climate change as a fraud and not a major crisis. The current GOP platform has only one paragraph in the 100-page document on global warming, and it strongly opposed the Kyoto Protocol on reducing carbon emissions. On immigration, the current GOP platform endorsed the guest worker program pushed by President Bush and McCain. Now, conservatives are pushing for a hardline position that opposes all forms of so-called amnesty for undocumented immigrants. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
In recent months, the U.S. economy has been battered by the subprime mortgage crisis, a decline in consumer spending, and rising unemployment, while at the same time suffering the effects of skyrocketing prices for energy and food. These two forces, stagnation and inflation, were dubbed stagflation when they last appeared in the 1970s. The current economic downturn has been made more perilous with the recent failures of large mortgage firms and financial institutions like Bear Stearns and the IndyMac Bank of California. Consumer confidence has been further shaken by the uncertain status of mortgage finance giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The U.S. Congressional Budget Office recently estimated that the Bush administration's plan to bolster the unsteady mortgage companies would cost taxpayers $25 billion. Another factor exacerbating economic concern is the increasing disparity in wealth seen in the U.S. in recent decades. Many families had used the equity in their homes to borrow funds needed for education, health care, or luxury items such as new cars or televisions. But now that the housing market bubble has burst, many who use the rising values of their houses as a ready source of cash are now out of luck and out of money. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Doug Henwood, editor of Left Business Observer and author of the widely acclaimed book, Wall Street. Henwood examines the role of deregulation in ushering in many of the irresponsible lending practices that in part triggered the current economic crisis.
The current bout of inflation is being driven mostly by energy, but also by food prices, and wages are not by any means keeping up with that. And then we also have the stagnant economy, which is the result of the bursting of the housing bubble, the drag of high oil prices, and just really a lot of debts going bad. People were borrowing like crazy. We had a pretty weak expansion from 2001 through the end of 2007, and people had to borrow very heavily to sustain their anything like a normal level of consumption. Well, now that the economy is really weakening and a housing bubble has burst, there's really nothing to keep the economy stimulated. So we're seeing a deep underlying weakness, and actually it's kind of a surprise that it's not doing worse than it is, considering all these blows it's taken.
Now, tell us the role of the increasing disparity of wealth here in the United States and how that's contributed to what we're seeing develop here with the economic meltdown.
For about the last 30 or 35 years, we've seen a real stagnation in the incomes of people in the middle and lower part of the income distribution. People at the very top have done extremely well. Over the last 20 years or so, the income of the richest one-tenth of 1% is up about 200%. That is, people with incomes of $10 million or more. The incomes for the rest of us are actually down a little bit after adjusting for inflation over that same period. So tremendous, tremendous disparity. Those who have done best are the very, very richest. And if you go down the ladder to the merely rich, they've done a little less well. If you go down to the down through the upper middle class, they've done a little less well. People in the upper brackets, the top 10% of the population, are the only part of the American population who have seen anything like a sustained rise in their incomes over the last few decades. So to maintain something like a middle-class standard of living or the appearance of a middle-class standard of living, people have been borrowing very, very heavily. In the 70s and 80s, they borrowed. In the 90s, they borrowed against their credit cards. In the last 5 or 7 years, they borrowed very, very heavily in the mortgage market, either to buy houses, but also taking home equity loans. About half of the growth in consumption during the 2001-2005 period was financed directly or indirectly by housing. About half the growth in employment came that way. So we had this great speculative bubble in housing, very much like this great speculative bubble we saw in stocks in the late 90s. And anything resembling prosperity that was experienced by the rest of the population was just really a byproduct of these crazy speculative booms. So while we have the rich getting richer, they have to do something with their money, and it's a very convenient thing for them to do is lend it to people below them in the income ladder. That doesn't have the ring of a long-term strategy about it, but it's worked so far for the last 20 or 25 years. And every time we run into a little recession, run into a little trouble, it looked like this in the early 1990s, the early 2000s, it looked like maybe that model was coming to an end. Maybe it was really just not sustainable. It proved to have an afterlife both those times. We'll see if it's able to kickstart itself again after a period of trouble. This really looks like it's something of a reckoning. It just doesn't look like we can kickstart another bubble to get things going again.
Doug, the conservative mantra for decades has been deregulation, privatization. And when we look at some of the bank failures and the instability in the stock market, the mortgage debacle, tell us a little bit about the role of deregulation here, and with particular attention to the Glass-Steagall Act, which was, I believe, a Depression-era piece of legislation that was repealed in 1999. Maybe you could explain Glass-Steagall.
Glass-Steagall did a couple of things. It kept the insurance business separate from regular kinds of investment or commercial banking, and also separated investment and commercial banking. All these distinctions between the various branches of the financial industry have completely been erased in recent years. That blending of all these different lines of finance is part of the problem, but also just supervision and regulation has just completely gone out the window. We've had a number of financial bust-ups in the last 20 or 25 years. We had the whole savings and loan debacle of the late 80s, early 90s. We had the junk bond disaster that same period. We had the dot-com bust. We had the Mexican and Asian financial crises in the mid-90s. Now we've had the housing bubble bursting. And every one of these, there's been no re-regulation, no attempt at increasing supervision, no attempt to require disclosure. And in most cases, getting out of these financial messes we got into required the expenditure of public money. And you'd think that kind of aggressive public sector intervention would, the public sector would get something in return. There might be some increased regulation or increased disclosure requirements or better supervision, but no. I mean, these guys just get a blank check. So they can do incredibly reckless things in the upcycle, go bust in the downcycle, and get rescued by the government. You'd wish they would apply some of the language they used to use about welfare mothers to these irresponsible bankers. These guys have just gotten a blank check from the federal government. And if you have a blank check, you'll just go and do the same thing over again. So there's talk about changing things this time around. We'll see, but the record has been that these guys not only get a blank check, they get an even longer line of credit every time they get in trouble.
That was Doug Henwood, editor of Left Business Observer and author of the widely acclaimed book, Wall Street. Read his articles online at leftbusinessobserver.com. In its waning days, the Bush administration is trying to put federal rules in place that could severely limit women's access to birth control by linking it to restrictions on abortion. The Department of Health and Human Services is about to propose and enforce regulations which would allow health care providers to deny low-income and uninsured women contraception. Americans are almost evenly split on support for a woman's right to abortion, but they overwhelmingly favor access to birth control. The new rules would, among other things, prohibit health programs receiving federal funding from refusing to hire health providers who object to abortion and even certain types of birth control. New regulations would also override provisions in 27 states that provide insurance coverage for contraceptives. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mary Jane Gallagher, president of the National Family Planning and Reproductive Health Association, about the White House efforts to implement these rules and the campaign underway to oppose them.
It's very interesting in the federal government. You can take, you can change rules and guidelines through a process, and it's literally filing them in a federal register, having a 30-day comment period, and after that, the rules go into effect. During the 30 days, you can file all the objections you want. There is also, there's a couple mechanisms, one of which is congressional interference and basically passing a law that would say this can't happen. The only problem we have with the Congress is we don't have a distinct majority that we can count on, and since this is the administration's proposed rules, they would likely veto, and the Congress couldn't override the veto.
What exactly does this mean? A reproductive rights organization that receives federal funding means they wouldn't be able to not hire someone who is qualified in every other way, but actually oppose the very reason for existence of the organization? I can see a whole fifth column going into these places.
Well, that's exactly what the fear is. You know, we've read the newspaper and heard about local pharmacies every now and then who refuse to fill a birth control prescription. But these regulations seek to make that okay with anyone in a family planning clinic, doctors in emergency rooms. I mean, really broad swipe at anyone being able to hand the prescription from the doctor to the patient and refuse to give it to them.
Mary Jane Gallagher, how many organizations or agencies would be affected by this new rule?
My organization represents over 4,000 family planning clinics across the country. So that includes Planned Parenthood, that includes a local family council provider, or in many states, it means in your county public health unit where you go to get a physical. If you're a low-income woman or do not have health insurance, you could receive contraception in all of these facilities around the country. So this has a very chilling effect on reproductive health services being offered women and men around the country.
What's being done to oppose it, or is this on its way to becoming a fait accompli?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, we have many organized efforts. We've had, you know, several thousand people, advocates, write in to Secretary Leavitt. And then we've had, you know, leading members of Congress like Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senator Hillary Clinton, send major signals to the administration that this isn't going to happen. Litigation is a very, very potential possibility here. Again, taking way too much money to fight for a basic right, a basic health care need in this country. But I think there's enough women who not only use contraception but believe that others should have access to it that are willing to stand up and say this isn't right. There's two other parts of this of these proposed regulations that are just as egregious. One is explicitly in these regulations, the goal by this administration is to outlaw certain forms of contraception. And how do they do that? They do that by expanding the definition of abortion to include birth control pills, IUDs, and emergency contraception, which is, again, unheard of. And the other is something that very rarely happens in this country, and that is that these regs would override existing state laws. We have many states on the books who say if a woman's raped and she comes into an emergency room, that they must provide her emergency contraception because she was raped. This administration wants to take that away from rape victims. You've got a situation where Americans all around this country support the need to reduce unintended pregnancies and the need for abortion, not take them away. We all desperately believe that it should be a woman's choice with her doctor or with her mate or her husband. But these regs seek to make contraception something widely used in this country and make it just like receiving an abortion and therefore restricting access to it. And finally, there's 27 states in this country that protect a woman like myself who's lucky enough to have health insurance. This administration wants to take away health insurance coverage for contraception. So they haven't just targeted those who don't have money and are uninsured. They've targeted the yous and me's of the world who have contraception and access to it through our health insurance. You know, we thought for years and years that we fought back this small group of ideologues on the issue of abortion. Now they're coming after contraception.
That was Mary Jane Gallagher, president of the National Family Planning and Reproductive Health Association. Contact the group by calling area code 202-293-3114 or visit the Washington, D.C.-based group's website at nfprha.org. Ohio Democrat and two-time presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich has worked hard to win support for a serious investigation of impeachable offenses that he maintains were committed by President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. Kucinich and several other Democrats, including Representative Robert Wexler of Florida, advocate the removal of Bush and Cheney from office for what they charge were lies told to Congress and the American public about the rationale for the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and abuse of their power in ordering the torture of detainees and conducting warrantless surveillance on American citizens. After a series of previous efforts met with failure, Kucinich filed 35 articles of impeachment against Mr. Bush in early June that were referred to the House Judiciary Committee, which took no action. Although House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has long declared her opposition to impeachment, she recently approved a narrowly focused hearing on July 25th before the House Judiciary Committee that will avoid any debate on removing Mr. Bush from office. The hearing, to be chaired by Michigan Democrat John Conyers, will consider one of Kucinich's articles of impeachment dealing with the manipulation of pre-war Iraq intelligence and other Bush scandals. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Elizabeth de la Vega, former U.S. prosecutor and author, who assesses the symbolic nature of the upcoming hearing and other ways the public can hold the Bush administration accountable.
Actually, in a sense, the hearing is narrow, but in another way, it's actually going to be very broad, almost to the point of ridiculousness, kind of along the lines of the complete works of Shakespeare in 10 minutes, because what they're having is a two-hour hearing, which I think is going to involve at least 9 different witnesses, and the topics are not just the latest article of impeachment filed by Dennis Kucinich, but many other topics, including the politicization of the U.S. Attorney's offices, the rendition, the signing statements, all the various issues that have been discussed with regard to the president over the last several years. So it's difficult for me to understand how there could be any serious discussion of any of those topics.
What's the point here? What's the goal? Is it just to placate Representative Kucinich? I doubt Nancy Pelosi has to do that. But what do you think is at work here behind the scenes?
Well, I am not an insider by any means, so I can only speculate. But there are a number of people on the Judiciary Committee who do now support moving forward with impeachment in one form or another. So I think it's a response to that pressure. And actually, across the United States, there's a huge movement for impeachment and an even larger and an actual majority of people who believe that the president lied about the war. So it seems to me kind of a bait and switch and definitely some kind of salvo to Kucinich and to the pro-impeachment people, making people feel that something's being done when, in fact, nothing really will be done. I hate to say that, but it certainly looks like a kind of a sham, actually.
When the Democrats took the House and Senate in 2006, there was a lot of pressure brought on them to begin impeachment proceedings by yourself and many other grassroots efforts around the country. Nancy Pelosi responded by saying this was not politically practical, that somehow this would distract the Congress from doing the business of the people, et cetera, et cetera. But what are the strongest arguments for impeachment that you can make today at this late date with just 6 months left in office for President Bush and Dick Cheney? Is there a case that could still effectively be made, you know, with just these remaining months of the Bush presidency?
Well, absolutely. If you just take the one article of impeachment that Dennis Kucinich just put forward, that is actually narrowly focused on the president's misrepresentations to Congress in order to get the authorization to use military force against Iraq. That's actually a very easily proved article of impeachment because we have a wealth of evidence already that shows that the president specifically made false statements both written form and orally to the public, at least. He didn't speak directly to Congress usually, but all of those went towards convincing Congress to authorize the use of military force. So the record is there, and it just needs to be put together in a format that could actually be done in one day. And the bottom line is, what we have to decide as a country is it ever too late to hold our chief executive accountable for the highest of crimes one can imagine, which would be misrepresenting the cause for war, the case for war, rather. Just about every aspect of his arguments for war was misrepresented, with the end result that we invaded a country 8,000 miles away that had done nothing to us and was not in any position to do anything to us, with the results that we now tragically have. Is it really ever too late to hold someone accountable for that? You know, if you analogize to the criminal justice system, most prosecutions occur after a crime is committed, and no one would really seriously argue that it would be too late to hold someone responsible for a crime that resulted in thousands and thousands of deaths in the criminal justice system. In this case, however, the crime is continuing. So, yes, I think it's really never too late.
Is there anything that could be done after President Bush and Vice President Cheney leave office to hold them accountable for illegal acts defying the norms of the Constitution, mm-hmm. that they could be held accountable for after they leave office? Is there anything that either legislators or citizens could initiate to really set the historical record straight? And I think more important than anything is to constrain future presidents from violating the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Well, theoretically, of course, there are things for which they could be prosecuted within the United States, but as a practical matter, I don't see either presidential candidate allowing that to happen. But I do think that internationally, they may very well be in jeopardy of being charged with war crimes having to do with either the initiation of the war in the first place or, more likely, the renditions and the torture. They are clear violations of international law, and I would think that they should be a little bit concerned about traveling outside of the country. Beyond that, legislatively, I can't really think of what Congress could do, especially because they seem to have this penchant for retroactively making things legal when they were previously illegal. Perhaps some sort of a full-fledged Truth and Reconciliation Commission kind of thing would be the best answer, and I would actually support that as at least something to do to get the record clear and complete.
That was former federal prosecutor Elizabeth de la Vega, author of the book United States versus George W. Bush et al., published by Seven Stories Press. Read her articles online at pubrecord.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.